the SR-71 Blackbird, from the perspective of someone with 756 hours in type. I'm Paul Plank, and this is Aero News. Welcome into this Aero News special feature, and thanks for downloading us today. My guest is Colonel Richard Graham, retired of the U.S. Air Force, and Rich has an area of expertise that not a lot of people do, and that is in the SR-71 Blackbird. I've been blessed the last few years to live in the Pacific Northwest within a brief driving range of the Evergreen Aviation Museum in McMinnville, Oregon, where there's an SR-71 on display, and was doing some reading about it over the last few days and thought Rich would be a great person to talk to. Rich, thanks very much for taking a few minutes out to talk to our listeners today.
My pleasure, Paul.
Now, the SR-71 strikes me, when you look back at some of the numbers associated with this aircraft, it had some characteristics and capabilities that really haven't been exceeded since this aircraft went into service in the 1960s. This was kind of the ultimate meeting of brute force and finesse.
Well, when Kelly Johnson built the airplane in 1962 and had its first flight on April 26th of 1962, it had set all of the world speed records, altitude, close course, and a straight line that have never been equaled by anyone yet. As far as a turbojet aircraft now, you may hear and read about some MiG that did a zoom climb up to, 150,000 feet and came back down. But these are not sustained altitudes. I mean, the SR-71 cruised at 85,000 feet and above, continuously cruising.
Right. And it's interesting, too, in that it was obviously well-designed for its task because, as I guess was not discovered until after it had been in use for a while, actually cruising at Mach 3 or 3.2 or whatever was more efficient than slower speeds.
Yes. The SR, once you pass through about 1.7 Mach thereabouts, it becomes extremely more efficient the faster you fly it. It's the only mechanical engine I've ever seen in the world that the faster you fly it, the more efficient it becomes. And what happens is, passing through about 1.6, 1.7 Mach, the aircraft starts to exhibit ramjet principles, and Kelly built the inlets to do that. And you could see it as a pilot in the cockpit rather dramatically. If, let's say, I was flying and I was 2,000 pounds low on the fuel curve, if you pushed it up and went from Mach 3.0 to, let's say, 3.2 and stayed there for about 15 minutes or so, your fuel flows are dropped down tremendously, and you could be back on your full fuel curve in no time at all.
Well, and I would imagine in the mission profiles that were assigned to this aircraft, that was a very important thing to know.
Well, it was, but I have to caveat that. There's not all the time you could have that latitude to speed up. There were many, all our missions were planned down to the point where the pilot had to hold the exact parameters, particularly in turns, because the turns are constant radius turns programmed into the computers. And if you exceed the ground speed, by the time you start entering the turn, you slide outside the turn, it can only bank up to a maximum, a very absolute maximum of 45 degrees of bank to try and catch up to stay on that black line, if you will. And if you're, so the pilots had to play the speed real close. So on the straight legs going to and from, that's when you can make up your fuel if you need to be. But not when you're in the very sensitive area in foreign airspace. You just couldn't do that.
Tell us a little bit about how these missions were planned, and I'm not going to ask you to tell us anything you're not supposed to, but when you say it was on a very tightly planned mission, that sounds to me like this itself might be a hazard in this kind of mission. Wasn't there a danger ever considered that being on too predictable a course would be a downfall?
Well, predictability means you're doing it day in and day out, and we didn't do that. We changed our routes, times, and everything all the time. So we tried to reduce that element of probability and repetition, so the bad guys could not figure it out. Although we had some what we called some can missions, like flying through the Korean DMZ, we were always doing that out of Okinawa and flying. That was one of our bread and butter missions, if you will, flying through the DMZ while we imaged up into North Korea. And oh, by the way, everything about the SR and where we went and what we did is all declassified. So anything you like to talk about, we can do that.
Oh, it is? Okay.
Yes.
Well, when I went to visit the Aviation Museum at McMinnville, the Evergreen Museum, there were actually some parts of the aircraft that were placarded, with less information. It said some of the electronics and countermeasures still had not been declassified.
And that's only because when we declassified the airplane in 1990, some of those sensors and some of the parts of those sensors and pieces and bits and information transferred over to the U2 program, which is still an active program. So, yes, there are those kinds of little things, but very, very about the actual airplane or what we did or where we went.
Tell us a little bit about your career arc and how you got into the Air Force, and specifically how you were drawn to and accepted in the desire to fly the SR-71.
Well, I started out when I was a tender age, a young kid. My dad was a Navy pilot and flew the Corsair and the reserves, and he got me out to the local airport in Pennsylvania, and I started working out there in my summers, just cutting grass and washing airplanes, pumping gas, those kinds of things. And he had his instructor's rating, so he sold me out at the age of 16, me and my brother both. And that got me the big desire to want to get in the Air Force, because then I found it very strange that someone actually paid you to fly airplanes. So that was my big goal, and I went to college at Akron University, and I got in the Air Force in 1964. Stayed on as a T-37 instructor for 5 years, and then volunteer statement in Vietnam got me into the F-4. Flew that for the next 5 years in various capacities for a year and a half in Nam, where I got 210 combat missions. 65 of them were with Wild Weasel F-4s. Mm-hmm. And I was over at Okinawa. That was my follow-on assignment out of Vietnam, and I saw the SR-71 runs flying around the sky while I was flying my F-4s. And I said, you know, that'd be a neat airplane to try out for. So I just did. I put in my application. It's all volunteer. And you go out to Beale Air Force Base in California for a complete week of solid interviews, two proficiency flights in the T-38 where they evaluate you, in the SR-71 simulator, and you get to meet all the squadron personnel, commanders, all the way up to the wing commander, and they all have a vote, yes or no, on whether you're going to get into the program. And then you go back to where you came from, wait a month or two, and then you either get a letter of acceptance or one of denial.
Is there perhaps some additional background checking that goes on during that month?
Security clearances, yes. You have to enter the program to, you know, be able to get a top secret security clearance. So,
well,
but you can still get that if you didn't have it previously. So that wasn't a real showstopper, if you will.
Right. I mean, as long as you were secure.
Yes.
You make this sound kind of like a casual decision on your part. Was this a tough recruiting thing for them? I mean, was there a downside that they would tell you about that made the line shorter?
Well, it wasn't until I got into the program that I realized all the downsides, because when I eventually got into it, I became the squadron commander, and I was fortunate enough in 1987 to become the wing commander, Beale. So I knew that's when I started to get privy to all the insides about how the recruiting went. And the one thing I really looked for when you went through your physical at Beale was a very extensive physical, and you had about a two-hour meeting with a shrink, and I never figured out why that was until I got into the program. And it was to determine your ability, because there's a lot of hot shots in the Air Force, and fighter pilot mentality, where you just take an airplane and you go over here, you go over there, you look for targets of opportunity. You can't do that with the SR. The SR has to stay on that black line the entire time, and that is your goal as a pilot, is to keep that airplane on the black line. Once you deviate off the black line, you had to abort, automatic abort. So the mentality to do that, you just could not take the airplane and take the autopilot off and say, oh, I want to go over here today, or I want to fly over there. That is impossible. You just can't do that.
Well, when you say it's impossible, what is the significance of the black line? Was that for...
That's the line that the mission planners drew on our maps, basically. That's just a term we used within the squadron, staying on the black line. You know, just if you draw a route, that's your black line, basically.
Well, I mean, why was it planned that tightly?
Because of fuel, because of you need to be exactly where you're supposed to be all the time. I mean, you're being monitored by a lot of other systems. You're not up there by yourself.
Well, in terms of the mission, though, was it specifically so you could photo or radar the specific targets?
Yes. Were there all photo. It's all what I call wet film photography and radar imagery. Mm-hmm. And getting to and from the targets, you still had to be on the black line. But once you got into the sensitive area, and that sensitive area is that airspace defined where anything and everything could happen. It could be MiGs coming up to try to get you. It could be SAMs fired at you or air-to-air missiles fired at you. That is defined as a sensitive area. Once you got into the sensitive area, you had to adhere to the black line. Now, obviously, if you're under a threat, if something's after you, we were allowed to obviously deviate and get the heck out of there. And we had other operational limits and speeds we could go to if need be to do that.
You had the unique ability among all the things that you could have flown in the Air Force to outrun missiles.
Yes, and that's what was nice about the SR, that the reason you didn't have to deviate off the black line, because there was very, very little threats out there that could come up and get you.
My guest is Air Force Colonel retired Richard Graham, one of the pilots of the SR-71 Blackbird. We'll be back with more in a moment. I'm Paul Platt, and you're listening to a special feature from Aero News.
Piperjet.
Pipersport.
Pipermatch.
Global expansion.
Meridian, Mirage, Matrix, and more.
With so much happening at Piper, how can I possibly keep up?
Get informed. Get involved at facebook.com/piperaircraft.
Diamond Aircraft's new DA-40 Diamond Star XL includes all popular Diamond options, combined with the sensational new Garmin GFC-700 Autopilot, a higher performance power plant, and increased gross weight. This makes the Diamond Star XL the perfect choice for affordable personal flying. The Diamond Star XL features equipment and enhancements that increase performance, capability, safety, convenience, and comfort. Visit Diamond on the web at www.diamondair.com or call 888-359-3320.
Welcome back to this Aero News special feature. I'm Paul Plack, talking today about the SR-71 Blackbird with Air Force Colonel retired Richard Graham, who logged 756 hours in the SR-71. Now, if I understand correctly, there were some crashes. The thing was obviously probably a little twitchy to fly under certain regimens, but none of these were ever shot down.
No, of all the Blackbirds, and that's three varieties of airplanes. That's the A-12, which is a single seat version flown by the CIA, and they flew that for 1 year, from May of 1967 to May of 1968 out of Okinawa, and they flew 29 sorties. It was a very short lived program with the CIA. So those are the A-12s, and the three YF-12s were built, which was supposed to be a look down, shoot down interceptor, which proved technically feasible, but the money wasn't there at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third variety is the SR-71, of which 29 were built. But if you add up all that Blackbird family, I call it, of aircraft, you'll come out with 50 total. And of that 50, over all the years, we lost 19 of the airplanes. Now, most of those losses were in the early days. And just to give you an example, from 1962 to 1972, so that's from the very first flight of 62, 10 years later, we only lost 18 of them. From 72 all the way to the close of the final program in 1997, we only lost one more aircraft. So what I'm trying to bring out here, that's a very steep learning curve to an airplane that was built with slide rule technology, no computers whatsoever, and on the leading edge of flying at Mach 3 where no airplane has ever gone before, and learning unusual phenomena like unstarts, high-altitude weather, the center of gravity of the airplane is very critical. We had a lot of people pitch up, and we lost the airplane. So that early days, we lost 18 of them, were mostly due to all just learning about the airplane. Like every time the crews crawled into the airplane back in the early days, they were on the leading edge every time of being a test pilot.
That's astonishing to think back on that. The plane did have some early analog computers, did it not?
Yes, it was all analog until probably the aircraft's biggest and most expensive upgrade occurred in the 1981-82. We went to a complete digital system for all the flight controls, all the computers, everything went digital. But it was analog up until about the early 80s.
Okay. Do you have any particular missions? Now, it says you flew 756 hours, which, according to my rough calculations, is going to come out to be somewhere between 1.5 and 2 million miles, at the speeds that these things fly. Are there any missions that stand out as memorable that have been declassified you can talk about? I guess you said all the missions
yes,
themselves have been declassified.
Yes, they have. I've had most missions that everyone else has flown, but people have had different experiences on. But I had one out of Okinawa that we were going up to the north. You take out southern Japan, which is the island of Okinawa. And if you know where the Kamchatka Peninsula is, just take the Aleutian chain and come on down and you get the Russian Kamchatka Peninsula.
Right.
The very southern tip of that peninsula was a place called Petropavlovsk. We called it Petro for short. And the Soviet side of it, they may still have there today, but at the time they had a very sensitive nuclear testing facility. And we would take off out of Okinawa and go up and image that. on one mission particularly, the weather was just right, clear skies, looking down from 80,000 feet. You could see the blue Pacific, Kamchatka Peninsula coming up off my left quartering nose. And about 200 miles up ahead, I could see contrails. And they were in a clockwise orbit, and it was three MiGs, MiG-25s as it turned out. And only because they were contrailing could I see them. Only because it was clear below I could see them. You know, if it was undercast, I obviously never would have seen them. But it was the perfect conditions, and I saw them down there. And they started to come out of trails. I got closer. As I got into about 100 miles, I'm just guessing about 100, they started to come out of the orbit, and they were in a 10-mile trail with each other. And pretty soon you could see the contrail disappear, so I knew roughly what altitude they probably stroked the burners and were trying to pop up to get me. And I just knew they couldn't, so I never really deviated off the black line, just kept on pressing up towards Petropavlovsk. And ironically, I told my backseater, Don Emmons, who was my RSO, and I said, "Don, turn on your view sight." And in the backseat, the RSOs back there, they have a view sight that looks directly beneath the airplane. Mm-hmm. Tremendous magnification powers. So he turned it on, and I said, "Tell me when they all start going by." And he would say, "Okay, there goes number one, and there goes number two, and there goes number three." And these airplanes are just falling out of the sky, just, you know, running out of airspeed, altitude, and ideas.
Right. So they tried, but they couldn't.
Yeah, they
couldn't
get benign. Yeah, it was all benign. And you like I say, that's part of the sensitive airspace, that you don't know whether you're going to be intercepted, shot at, or for all I know, I was just a high altitude practice intercept for them. You don't know what's going to happen.
Well, sure.
You don't know if they're cleared to fire or not, because the Soviets control very much about who's cleared to fire and who's not going to fire from ground.
Well, and at that point, you were probably not the first one they'd seen, so they may have used you as a routine practice target.
Again, you'd never know.
Rich, I suspected when we got into this topic that this might happen, but we're out of time for today. Could I impose upon you to come back tomorrow and tell us a little bit about the two books you've written about the SR-71?
Yes.
In the meantime, you can find out more about Rich and his books and the SR-71 at www.habu.org. And we'll be back with more tomorrow. My guest is Air Force Colonel retired Richard Graham, and you've been listening to a special feature from Aero News. On the web, you'll find us at www.aero-news.net. I'm Paul Plack. Thanks for listening. Have a clear and unlimited day.